It is Monday, August the 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for being with us today. Coming up, a big rally in Turkey and the latest on the country's president.
Erdogan is a man who reacts on impulse and on basically friend-enemy calculus rather than in a dispassionate long-term way.
Also ahead, a key election in Thailand, the Hong Kong pro-independence movement, lots of Olympic news, plus what singer Britney Spears is up to. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan vowed Sunday that Turkey will continue fighting whatever powers are seeking to undermine the government. He addressed a massive flag-waving rally in Istanbul in the wake of the country's abortive July 15th coup. The rally by a million people was the largest, some Turkish media say, they had ever seen. It marked an end to 3 weeks of nightly demonstrations since that failed coup that claimed the lives of more than 270 people, including 34 who helped plan the coup. For some perspective on what appears to be heavy public support for President Erdogan, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with James Jeffrey, as a former U.S. ambassador to Turkey, now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
There's a lot of public opposition to this coup, and this was missed in the United States, Victor, because the Erdogan has a bad reputation. But even paranoids sometimes have reason to worry. And this coup was a real effort to undercut democracy, almost certainly by, or at least partially by, the Gulenist movement, which is another religious movement that used to be allied with Erdogan but now has split with him. And so I think that there are troubling aspects to this. But on the other hand, most people have decided that, A, it's a good thing the coup, a very good thing that the coup did not succeed. B, people are proud that the population stood up against it, including most of the military acted against the coup plotters. And C, they want to show solidarity for their democratic state. Now, Erdogan, of course, will use this. He's a politician. He is seeking ever more power. He wants a constitutional system. And I think the opposition, basically by going along, is trying not to essentially oppose him on a losing issue, which is to look like they weren't enthusiastically opposed to the coup, because, in fact, their party people and their voters were also opposed to the coup in the vast majority.
Are you saying that there is not widespread support for him?
I would say, and we saw this in polls just before the coup, his support hovers between 40 and 50%. By Turkish terms, that's quite good. That's a strategic plurality. But that means that half the country, at least at any given time, is opposed to his policies.
Anytime you can draw a million or more people into one area showing support with banners and shouts and so forth, you would think he had widespread support for what he did.
Well, as I said, the 50% of the population, between 40 and 50% that supports him in some cases very strongly. And again, this was an effort for people to wrap themselves around the banner of national unity against the coup.
The military is undergoing a major restructuring, apparently with very little, if any, parliamentary oversight, with thousands of soldiers discharged, including about 40% of the generals. What impact would this have on the fight against Islamic State and other terrorists?
Very little. I mean, the military is not deeply engaged in the fight right now against ISIS, per se. The military is engaged far more against the PKK and basically dealing with internal order and worrying about Syria. I mean, they have many problems. So I don't see this having any particularly significant effect on the campaign against ISIS.
There was a protest here outside the White House Sunday. Several hundred people clad in red waving Turkish flags in front of the White House, support of Mr. Erdogan demanding that President Obama deport Fethullah Gulen to Turkey. How likely is that?
Well, it's a court decision. It's not an Obama decision. And it'll depend on a lot of issues, beginning with a very good court case. This isn't something that happens easily.
Are you convinced Mr. Gulen had some sort of involvement in this?
I would not be surprised, but as I haven't seen a specific evident, element of proof that he personally did it, I would have to say I would not be surprised.
Mr. Ambassador, Mr. Erdogan is to meet President Vladimir Putin of Russia on Tuesday in St. Petersburg for talks that may end a period of tension between the two countries. Is that a good or bad thing?
It's a bad thing. Well, the tensions were not a good thing because there was a risk of another military conflict, as they had. But Putin doesn't mean anything good for the Middle East, for Turkey, or for the West.
Do you see any fundamental change in Turkey's relationship with NATO or the European Union as a result of what's happened?
I don't think so, but you have to watch this very carefully because Erdogan is a man who reacts on impulse and on basically friend-enemy calculus rather than in a dispassionate long-term way. So we have to watch it.
That is James Jeffries, a former U.S. ambassador to Turkey, now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. And among the other stories we're following on The Voice of America, Iran executing a nuclear scientist for spying for the U.S., mudslides triggered by tropical storm Earl killed 38 in Mexico, plus the entire Russian team banned from the Rio's Paralympic Games in a fallout over the doping scandal. That and a lot more at voanews.com and as always on the VOA mobile app. Rebels breached the Syrian government's siege on opposition neighborhoods in the city of Aleppo, opening a corridor in the south and marking a major military breakthrough. That battle for Aleppo, which is Syria's largest city and former commercial heart, is pivotal for the Syrian civil war. University of San Francisco Middle East scholar Stephen Zuna spoke with VOA about the rebel gains.
This is a pretty remarkable turnaround for the besieged rebels. Somehow they were able to get no less than 30 different armed factions to cooperate in breaking through this siege and taking over this heavily fortified military area, including an artillery school and a major base. The population of 300,000 people who have been in a desperate situation for some time or were out in the streets celebrating, even those, of course, who are not very happy with the leading role of some hardline Islamist factions. But no doubt when you're in that desperate shape, you don't care who helps you out in that situation, as long as some kind of humanitarian relief, and including badly needed food, can get through. Whether this is just a temporary setback for the Syrian regime or sign of a turn of the tide, they are no doubt going to continue to unleash heavy air power, which, as we have seen over the past nearly 5 years, has led to huge numbers of civilian casualties. It's also a reminder that in the seesaw battle in this war, which has included many different armed factions, it's not the kind of conflict that's going to be settled militarily. There's going to have to be some kind of political settlement, even though at the moment that seems very far off.
Stephen Zunas, a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. Voters in Thailand have gone to the polls on a new constitution proposed by the ruling military, and they have approved it. Though the military says the draft constitution would reduce political divisions in the country, critics have argued it would give the military too much power. This man in Bangkok spoke with reporters after voting. He said this is an important vote because after there will be an election, and then he says democracy will follow. Elections are expected next year and have been promised by the junta should their constitution pass. In other news, candidates banned from standing for election in Hong Kong because they are advocating a split from mainland China have led the city's first pro-independence rally as tensions over the upcoming vote have escalated. Five pro-independence candidates who tried to register were rejected by election officials who said their stance went against Hong Kong's mini-constitution. Critics have slammed the move as censorship as fears grow over Beijing's interference in a wide range of areas from politics to media as well as education. VOA's Steve Miller has an explanation of what's going on.
Hong Kong's Legislative Council is slated to hold an election for new members on September 4th. During past election cycles, candidates only needed to attest that they would uphold the basic law, essentially Hong Kong's constitution, and pledge allegiance to Hong Kong itself. However, this time, candidates running for office need to sign an additional pledge that Hong Kong is an inalienable part of China. Chan Ho-tin and Yung Kei Chung refused to sign the pledge, which then resulted in the Hong Kong Electoral Affairs Commission banning them from the election. Edward Long, who in the past had advocated for Hong Kong's independence, won a seat in the Legislative Council during a by-election in February of this year. He signed the new pledge proclaiming One China, but was informed this week that he was barred from participating in the election.
It is very obvious that Hong Kong nowadays is not a place of rule of law. It is a place ruled by men, ruled by the Communist Party. This decision is illegal, but they are still doing so because they dare to do so. They dare us that we will not do anything against this authority, but that's not true. Hong Kong people will still continue to fight for our autonomy.
VOA contacted the Electoral Affairs Commission, but it declined the interview request. John Minnick, East Asia analyst for Stratfor.
I do think that what we see in a broader sense with Beijing's policy towards Hong Kong is that in some sense, I think they're coming to realize what a liability even the concept of Hong Kong autonomy is to Beijing's larger political goals.
Part of those political goals, Minnick says, came to light when Beijing detained Hong Kong booksellers through extrajudicial renditions, something he calls
extreme measures that we haven't seen before. And I think that they indicate that the government, they're in some sense moving to a position where Beijing has larger political goals it's pursuing, and it's willing to step back or to draw back against the one country, two systems principle if it needs to in order to achieve those goals.
David Lampton, director of China Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, says China had been trying to instill confidence in its governing practices, especially with regard to Hong Kong, Macau, and Taiwan. But he notes that their latest moves are having the opposite effect.
Since Xi Jinping has come into office, there's been a similar political tightening in the People's Republic of China. And I think as the tolerance for dissent in China itself goes down, of course, the tolerance for dissent in attached cities such as Hong Kong is also going down. Where it ultimately ends up in terms of degree of tolerance is anybody's guess. But I think the space for civic activity and what I call citizen participation in meaningful governance. Unfortunately, that's going down in both China and, I'm afraid to say, Hong Kong.
While there remains a lack of clarity of the impact this kind of move will have on Hong Kong, John Minnick says,
this move is not a one-time event, not a one-time shot, but a node in a larger process that we see unfolding in the same basic trend going forward.
Steve Miller, VOA News, Washington.
And we now have 2 days of the Rio Olympics behind us. A few events to note. Sadiq Umar scored a first-half goal, and Nigeria defeated Sweden 1-0 to become the first team to guarantee a spot in the quarterfinals of the men's soccer tournament. Longqing Guan of China set a world record in winning the gold medal in the men's weightlifting 53-kilogram category. Katie Ledecky from suburban Washington gave the United States its first swimming gold medal, crushing her own record world record in the women's 400-meter freestyle. New Zealand survived a tough encounter against an energized U.S. team to win their quarterfinal 5-0 and join the World Series champion Australia, Canada, and Britain in playing off of the first Olympic medals in rugby sevens. And speaking of rugby, the sport is seeking some newfound recognition after not being a part of the Olympics for nearly a century. VOA's Park Brewer is in Rio and has more on this rough but exciting team event.
It's been a game changer. That's how World Rugby Chairman Bill Beaumont, a former English player, describes the inclusion of rugby here at the 2016 Rio Olympics. When rugby was last held in the Summer Games in 1924, the United States men won a gold medal in a 15-a-side version of the sport. For Rio, the teams, both men and women, are playing sevens, which is seven players on a side. The U.S. men's and women's teams both qualified in the 12-nation draws for the six-day tournament. While Beaumont acknowledged that some of the top players who compete in 15-a-side did not make their country's sevens Olympic team, he believes new stars will emerge in Rio. World Rugby CEO, Australian Brett Gosper, said ticket sales for Olympic rugby have been good and that those attending games in Rio are in for a good sporting experience.
We think it's brilliantly designed, the stadium that we have, for spectators. What's great about sevens rugby is when the fans can be very close, sounds obvious, but the closer they are to the players, the better the atmosphere.
Irishman Mark Egan, World Rugby Head of Competitions and Performance, said having the women compete in sevens here, too, is important for the growth of the women's game.
It's a very attractive form of the game for young girls. And I think when, you know, people all around the world and women see the sport on TV and the Olympic coverage, I think there's going to be a huge upsurge in interest.
Gosper addressed what he believes it will take for rugby to remain an Olympic sport.
What really is important is the percentage of fill of your stadia, the impact you have in social media, broadcast ratings in key Olympic markets, the atmosphere in the stadium, very important. I think volume ticket sales also is one of the criteria.
Gosper believes his sport will score well in all of those areas. VOA News at the Rio Olympics.
And many thanks, Hugh Park. You know, there is a lot of Olympics news, too much to mention in a program, but you can find more at voanews.com. And also from the world of sports and U.S. pro baseball, Japan's Ichiro Suzuki and his team, the Miami Marlins, play the Colorado Rockies on Sunday. Well, the big news was Suzuki.
And it's off the wall! 3,000 is in right field, and Ichiro is racing for third! And he's done it! He's climbed the mountain! A triple!
That's Rich Waltz making the call for the Miami Marlins. It was Suzuki's 3,000th career hit. After the game, Ichiro spoke to everyone, obviously speaking Japanese, but I've got a few words here for you to translate. It hasn't been too long, he says, since Japanese players have started to come to the United States to play in the majors. He still says there's very obviously more to be accomplished, but he did make his 3,000th hit. Obviously, we're not there yet, he says, but we're still out there and more is being done. 42-year-old Suzuki is in his 16th season in U.S. baseball. He got almost 1,300 hits while playing 9 years in Japan before becoming a U.S. Rookie of the Year and Most Valuable Player back in 2001. Also from the world of baseball, ending weeks of speculation over what would become of his tumultuous career with the New York Yankees, Alex Rodriguez announced Sunday that he will retire as a player effective on Friday. Rodriguez described himself as someone who tripped and fell a lot but kept getting up. And from the world of pro golf, Jim Furyk has a place in history now, all to himself, a new magic number. 3 years after he became the sixth player on tour to shoot a 59, Furyk took it even lower on Sunday at the Travelers Championship with a 12-under 58. Furyk is the only PGA player with two sub-60 rounds. Now it's time to shift over to social media and see what's trending. My colleague G. Abby Lee is here. Hey, G., what's happening?
Hi, Steve. In the last couple of days, the online community talked a great deal about Green Party's presidential nominee, Jill Stein. The Green Party officially nominated Stein and her running mate, Ajamu Baraka, on Saturday. But Twitter users appear to be more fascinated with her singing ability than her winning the party's nomination.
And what's all the buzz about?
A couple of media outlets like Esquire and the New York Magazine reported on Stein's former career as, get this, a lead singer in a 90s rock band. Now, back in the 1990s, Stein was with a folk rock group called Somebody's Sister. The Esquire magazine's online article titled, "The Least Surprising Thing About This Election is Jill Stein's 90s Folk Rock Band," because, of course, she had one.
Not exactly your standard political career path. And what's the public's reaction to that?
Well, from what I can gather in Twitter and Facebook, millennials are liking some of the numbers the Esquire magazine included in the story. That's all for me today. Steve, back to you.
And many thanks to you, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. You can find G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And you can find our program, International Edition, on Twitter at VOA _IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Most people describe a black hole as a cosmic object with gravity so strong that it sucks in any kind of material that comes close to it. What happens to stuff that's pulled into a black hole? Well, some scientists think that matter that enters a black hole gets crushed into a tiny point at its center called a singularity and is then destroyed. A new Spanish study proposes that matter may survive its trip into a black hole and then it exits out its other side. The study suggests that the black hole's singularity, or center, could be compared to an imperfection in the geometric structure of space-time, such as a wormhole. After an object enters the black hole, it would be stretched, or as the astrophysicists call it, spaghettified, which allows it to enter the wormhole. After the object exits the wormhole, it would be restored to its normal size and shape. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. You know, one of the biggest pop stars of the past 20 years is back, but, well, did she ever really leave? Well, you just have to know where she performed. My colleague Jim Stevenson speaking now with VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald.
The return of Britney Spears. I'm dreaming of my Her ninth studio album, Glory, is finally here. It was announced on August 3rd. The album itself arrives on Friday, August 26th. And both it and the lead single, Make Me, they've been in the works for a while. They have been much delayed because of reported production issues. Now, those production issues, of course, can encompass many things. I have heard that label executives were not initially thrilled with the quality of the singing and the production, but everything's been ironed out now. Make Me did very well in its first week on the Hot 100. It opened at number 17. This is Britney's 20th top 20 single since 1998. It's her 34th Hot 100 single, and it's her first countdown single in 3 years.
Doesn't seem that long.
So while we're waiting for Glory, some of her fans got a look at the cover photo. They weren't very pleased. Some of them have started an online petition at change.org so that they can force RCA Records to come up with another photo that they say more properly represents Britney's music. Now, I posted the photo on my Twitter timeline. Mm-hmm. It doesn't quite look like I remember Britney Spears. Now, of course, I mostly remember Britney Spears as a teenager.
Right.
Back in the late 90s and early 2000s. That was her commercial heyday. Britney is now 34 years old. She's a mother.
she's moved on. So maybe we should move on in our mental image of her.
Well, 3 years have passed.
Exactly right. And she's been more or less out of the media spotlight because she has been in Las Vegas doing her incredibly successful residency show, Piece of Me, at the Axis Auditorium, Planet Hollywood. Since its premiere in 2013, Piece of Me has consistently pulled capacity crowds. Britney has extended her contract well into next year. Right now, you can buy tickets for shows extending into next February. The show has been revamped a couple times, so she's keeping it fresh. Piece of Me has been credited with really changing the culture of Vegas entertainment, making it a very hot destination for young people. A string of big-name residencies have followed in the wake of Piece of Me. Jennifer Lopez, Mariah Carey, Celine Dion has a residency, Elton John, and Britney Spears is pretty much the template for this. Piece of Me, a lot of people were saying this thing's going to be a train wreck back in 2013. But instead, it has turned into a real money spinner for Britney. So whether or not Glory does well in the marketplace, her career is thriving.
It just adds another dimension to what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
That's right.
Well, one thing that always works is our residency with Ray McDonald. Catch him every week for the Top 20 Countdown.
Thursdays on VOA 1. And please drop by my Twitter feed at Ray on the Hits and say hi.
Thanks so much, Ray.
All right, Jim.
And many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America. For our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Jonah Cummings, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In Nigeria, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, has launched two new partnerships with local agribusinesses, Babangona and Hello Tractor. These two new projects highlight the U.S. government's commitment to agriculture-led economic growth and private sector engagement as part of Feed the Future, the U.S. government's Global Hunger and Food Security Initiative. This $2 million two-year partnership will allow 45,000 smallholder farmers across seven states and the Federal Capital Territory easier access to smart tractors that better meet their needs, improved seeds, and profitable food and agriculture markets. During the ceremony at the U.S. Embassy in Abuja in late July, which was attended by Nigerian Minister of Agriculture, Audu Ogbe, U.S. Deputy Chief of Mission Maria Brewer described the partnership as a co-investment in public goods. Innovation and entrepreneurship hold the key to unlocking Nigeria's agricultural potential, and the U.S. government will continue to provide support in this direction, said Ms. Brewer. Under the Feed the Future initiative, the U.S. government collaborates with a wide range of partners, from civil society groups to host country governments to the private sector, to support smallholder farmers in Nigeria and other countries across Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean. Through these partnerships, Feed the Future addresses development and business challenges by increasing access to improved agricultural inputs and mechanization, better quality technical advisory services, and expanding market opportunities for smallholder farmers. These partnerships capitalize on the untapped potential of youth in agriculture and help build the capacity of young entrepreneurs to help grow their businesses, create secure jobs, and boost economic growth. Through the partnership with USAID, Babangona will help 20,000 smallholder farmers, and Feed the Future's partnership with Hello Tractor will enable 24,500 smallholder farmers to gain access to tractor services, as well as train 100 youth entrepreneurs on owning and maintaining a fleet of smart tractors. In its partnership with Nigeria, the United States helps stabilize Nigerian society with improved social services, supports transparent and accountable governance as a responsible regional and trade partner.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
for